Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by former CIA analyst Yahya Jassafanousi, who specialized in counterterrorism and illicit finance. He joins me today to discuss the national security implications of digital currency. I hope you find this episode interesting. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Yahya, welcome back to the podcast. It's great to have you on, and it's been a little while. How are you?
Chris, I'm great, and it's wonderful to be here. I don't remember. I mean, I think you go back to our early podcasting days, you know. I'm thinking like 2015 or something like that. So yes. I appreciate, or 16, but I appreciate the time. Yeah, I appreciate the time.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I mean, you were my third ever guest on the show, which was fantastic. And the show has evolved over the years, and now we're on YouTube, which we weren't before in the old days. It's amazing how things have kind of gone on. And we're on season 10 now, so it's crazy.
Wow. And so much, yeah. So, I mean, to bring you up to speed, I mean, because when we first talked on that third show, I mean, I was doing work. I was at a think tank. I was doing a lot of research and writing on illicit finance and national security. I was on my first podcast at that time back in the day, and now I do a lot more in podcasting. And now I work more in the digital assets, cryptocurrency, digital currency space. I'm sure we'll get all into that.
Yes, indeed. Today is very kind of crypto, illicit finance kind of space today, which will be very interesting. So you wrote this really interesting paper called The Programmable State, which has been published by Lawfare. And you wrote this with a lady called Emily Jin. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about that paper, what motivated you and Emily to write it, and also how you went about researching it as well.
Thank you. Thanks for mentioning Emily. Emily Jin is my co-author for that paper. And we started, that actually is a project that is the result of a few years of research, because back in 2021, I believe, we released our first paper on China's central bank digital currency. So that was way back in, like I say, 2020 or 2021. Mm. We had been, you know, as part of, at the time, we were both part of the Center for a New American Security, a DC-based bipartisan think tank on national security issues. And we were looking at what was happening back then, which was China had unveiled or had started to unveil its own digital currency. And so this was something that a lot of people were wondering about. It's this new technology. So we started researching it. And then after a few years, there was sort of a lull. China had announced it, And people were writing about it. What does this mean? Really, the issue of digital authoritarianism is what people were thinking about, because if the Chinese state has a digital currency, does that mean it's going to control its population? So that's what people were wondering about. But when the pilot, so China's digital currency, this is something run by its central bank, the People's Bank of China. And in the years between, let's say, 2022 to 2023, 2024, it started to unveil these pilots piloting its digital currency. And I can explain more about how that works. But we were interested in, you know, finding out, well, how are these pilots working? What is happening? And what are the national security implications for the U.S., for the power of the Chinese party? And so we decided to take a look a little bit more deeply. And earlier this year, we published a follow-up report called The Programmable State.
So for listeners who find this topic intimidating, and I'll put myself in that category, because anything to do with the finance, digital currency, I'm like, wow, what is this about? So could you provide us just a simple explanation of what digital currency and central digital bank currency are?
Yeah, so well, I'll first with what you already know and what a lot of people already say. They'll say, hey, I've been using digital currency for decades. Mm. I'm banking online. I have you know, mobile money. I've been using digital currency. So what's new about this? And what I would say is that what has happened more recently has been technology has allowed a new format for digital currency, we could say. So it's what we call digital currency now. And I'm going to actually use a term because I think this is more where the conversation is going now in policy circles, digital asset. Digital assets, this is now becoming a term amongst finance people, regulators, governments. So I'll explain that. So a digital asset is simply a digital representation on value that is typically on some sort of distributed ledger. And a distributed ledger is just software where the record of transactions can be viewed by anyone, you know, or can be viewed by multiple people. Everyone has access to this ledger. So that's digital asset. But a central bank digital currency is a little bit different because it could be a digital asset, but it could be basically when the central bank decides, you know what, I'm central bank, right? Mm-hmm. The central bank says, we're going to directly issue our money digitally. And we're going to make it available, maybe make it available to banks or make it available to the consumer. That hasn't existed because before, the digital access we have is usually through the private banks. You go to your private bank, you go to their website, and then they sort of manage the transactions. It's not that you actually have a digital, you know, pound or the digital dollar. It's not really digital. It's really just the bank trying to represent it. So in recent years, what has happened is central banks have said, you know what, maybe we could be more efficient with our monetary policy, with how we view the economy. And so a central bank digital currency has been something that several central banks have been pursuing. But it's different from Bitcoin because, and gosh, please, I know if I'm getting, you just, if I'm getting, because I could be going too technical, so.
No, it's good. Go for it. And yeah, explain just a little bit about how this is different from Bitcoin and maybe even go into what Bitcoin is, just in case there's still some people out there who are.
Yeah. So yeah, Bitcoin is a digital asset. Bitcoin is it's a public system, a distributed ledger system. It was the first first blockchain really to provide a crypto asset. So what does it mean? So you think of Bitcoin as basically it's a software protocol. There's something called the Bitcoin protocol. And the software does something which never was able to be done before on the internet. Before Bitcoin, if you wanted to send money digitally, you had to use some sort of centralized third party, like a bank, right? In order to manage that, in order to credit, debit your account and then credit someone else's account, right? You had to have that. Bitcoin was this really ingenious invention to create a system where the transactions are recorded on a ledger that is distributed across computers that anyone can access. And in order to send a transaction, you just sort of need to access that software, access your account, and you're able to send or broadcast your transaction and the record is kept. So a Bitcoin is just a representation on that ledger. Like one Bitcoin is on the ledger and you can transfer that Bitcoin Bitcoin to someone else that's using the ledger, or half a Bitcoin, or 0.003. All of it is kept. And this is public software that anyone could access. It's not issued by a government. What's the value? A Bitcoin is based on the demand, what other people are going to pay you in dollars or in pounds or in euros in order to access it. So it's not the same as, you know, your regular currency. It's totally independent. Now, central banks, this, you know, Bitcoin was unveiled in 2008, 2009, it was deployed, and central banks noticed it. And central banks basically said, this is around the world. And actually, the UK was one of the early central banks that started to study Bitcoin, not because they wanted to reproduce it, but they said, wow, this is like a different way to keep track of a financial record. There might be something here. Now, we don't want to do Bitcoin because Bitcoin no one controls and, you know, there's illicit finance. Like, we're not going to do that. But why don't we study the properties of this system, of this distributed ledger system, and maybe we can implement parts of it for our own new digital currency system. And that's what's happening with China, or what China had started to look at. Although the architecture, to get a little bit technical, because some people are going to say, don't mess up this particular point. China's digital currency is not a fully blockchain-based system. I just have to say that it's more centralized. But anyway, so the China's digital currency, we started to look at it because, you know, we said, what does this give the state? What does this give the CCP to switch to this? Because a lot of people would say, you know, China has a very established financial technology sector, you know, WeChat, Alipay. Those are private firms that have mobile money, digital money. And people would be like, why does China need to create some new pilot of the digital renminbi or the digital yuan? It's called the ECNY, the sort of the official brand of this digital currency. And what they don't realize, we found this in our early research, is that the Chinese government, especially the central bankers, were saying these private tech companies have too much influence and power. They're private companies. They're not, you know, they're not run by the state. Oh, of course, they can be influenced by the state. But these they have access to data. They're doing things that maybe we don't want them to do. They're too big to fail. And so several years ago, the central bank started to say, you know what, let's create our own system. Let's create some infrastructure that the state will have more control over, that we can use to access data. And way in the background, here's something else. And this is what we found in our research. The Chinese Communist Party several years ago had put out a plan for financial technology, what we call fintech. So like a fintech development plan. And in that plan, This was a few years ago. It said that the aim of the state was to create eventually a sort of national data warehouse, with the idea that data in the society, data in business, data should be useful for state planning, for economic development, for policy, for lots of other things, for services, service delivery. So I would say that this is my take, is that China started to see that data is going to be a resource. In fact, the head of the CCP, said that data should be a factor of production, seen as like just like get energy, gas, electricity. So I even say that data is like the new electricity. Every application runs on what? Data. So data is in a digital environment, you need data. You need to manage it. You need to use big data analysis. And now with artificial intelligence, right, with AI, it's key. AI is driven by data. So if we think that strategically now data is important, what's happened is that China has tried to create a currency where the infrastructure is more overseen by the state. And that means that the state could have more control. And one of the, maybe I'll pause there because I'm going a little bit too deep here.
No. Carry on, because I think that's perfect. And yeah, go into surveillance and control and talk about that. Yeah.
So I should probably describe, because viewers and listeners are probably wondering, how does this ECNY work? How does China's digital currency work? And why do we call our paper the programmable state? So there's this system, a two-tier system. So what happens is the central bank, the People's Bank of China, really creates this digital currency. It's a native, it's currency made digitally. Mm. But it doesn't cut out the private banks, because most people go to private banks, right? That's how you usually go. There's some state-owned banks, but really, you know, it's the banks, the private banks, not the central bank that the people interact with. So they distribute the digital currency, the ECNY, to the private banks, and then people can access it. They can download wallets, and it'll be like a central bank wallet. But then, in order to get the ECNY, they have to open it up in one of the banks. And so this two-tier system means that even though the app you're using may be connected to your regular bank, the digital asset itself and the data that's around it, it really belongs to the government. It is their money. Mm. And it means, just take a step back, what that means, why that's different. Before, let's say I'm a Chinese citizen and, you know, I'm suspected of doing something illegal. What happens, and this is not just in China, this is actually what happens all around the world. All banks, maybe some of us don't know this, but banks, you know, file suspicious activity reports. They're always monitoring what their customers do. So if something happens, like let's say, you know, a transaction just seems very odd, all of a sudden you're sending out more money and it's going to an account that seems, you know, you've never sent to before, that could trigger an alert. Maybe that's not suspicious activity, but maybe there's something else that happened. Maybe you have a transaction with a known fraudster or something. So a bank will then write a suspicious activity report, and then that goes to the financial authorities. That goes to the government. And again, this is all over the world. This is in the US, the UK, Europe, China, everywhere. And then what happens is the government can then follow up on that. Maybe they'll investigate. Maybe they'll go back to the bank and they'll say, tell us more information. Give us everything you have on this individual. They don't know, because they don't have the government doesn't have access to the data itself or the accounts. They have to go to the bank. So they're removed. So everyone talks about Big Brother. Everyone says, oh, the government is surveilling you. The honest truth is that the technology does not really allow the government, any government, to have like a 360, you know, 360 24/7 view in real time of anyone's transactions. They're not monitoring, you know, they don't have like direct access, because the banking system, the technology is not set up that way. Mm. So there's like, there are these layers, and the government has to go through this process. Now, of course, in China, they can get the data quickly. It's like, hey, give us the data, you know, just because we said so. Here in other societies, you know, they have to have a subpoena, or they have to have some, you know, have to go through a process. But what this new technology offers is maybe to cut out the middleman in some ways, because you're dealing with a digital currency that essentially is government infrastructure. So the central bank is going to have access to the data. Now they would say that they're not going to have access to the names, that it would be anonymized, right? So that's what they have said. It's not that they know the names, but they can get the names easily, because if there's suspicious activity, they can go and say, hey, what's the name? And then attach it. You know, what do they do with that? What if the person is innocent? I mean, those are policy questions and privacy issues, but the setup is different now. The setup is such that the government can now analyze swaths of data. Let me give you a good some examples of also what's possible. And this could be for legitimate concerns. So data, so managing your budget expenditure. So China has not made this, has not just deployed this digital currency and now everyone's using it. In fact, it's a small number of people. Some people, you know, I know we have some friends, you know, they're in Beijing and they're in places in China. They're like, we're not seeing this. Where is this pilot? Because it's given sort of strategically to certain provinces, certain cities, certain test cases. So it's not mass adopted. But what we found in our research was we started to look, and this is because of Emily. I'm not even a China expert per se, right? I don't read or speak Mandarin, but my co-author, Emily, who speaks Mandarin and understands the China political system, political history, et cetera. You know, so we looked at press reporting of all these pilots that were coming out. Now, obviously, yes, it's influenced by the government, but these press reports would say, province such and such is partnering with the central bank and is now paying its employees in digital currency. So why is that interesting? Because now, let's say if you pay a budget to an agency in this ECNY, now the government can know Well, how much of it was spent? Where was it dispersed to? What is the rate of the budget? It's no longer a thing where you have to wait for a report to come back. The government can see because it's its own infrastructure. The other thing that is interesting, and some would say that that's a positive. That means you can have better accountability. If you're a government, you know where the spending is going. You know when the employees are getting paid and how much they're getting paid, right? So you know, this could be a double-edged sword to this. But here's something that we found interesting in our report. A lot of these pilots are experimenting with programmability. And I would call this, in a sense, smart money. And programmability is something, this is something that's very new that only exists in the digital currency space. Here's a rudimentary example of one of the pilots. So one of the pilots is, it's very simple. It's a pilot where the money, the ECNY, this digital yuan, could be used for educational services. And there is a system where you have a wallet and you pay the service provider. But the funds, this digital yuan, it goes into an escrow account. And the money does not get paid until the service is delivered and it's automatic. So because apparently there had been a problem in China with people paying for services and then not getting, you know, these education services and then not getting the service. So this programmability, because with this software, you can now create the wallet, you can create the functionality so that, hell, you pay it, but it doesn't go to them until they come through. That doesn't exist. Now, you may think, how could you do that today? You know, you hire someone to do a contract. Okay, maybe you just withhold the payment and you can go back legally. But this is a system where you do give the money and then it's held and then it goes to them. That is just one feature. There are other features where they were trying to, the government was trying to get people to shop locally and to promote more tourism. So they would distribute the money almost like a coupon where you had to pay at a particular, you had to pay, the money could only be spent at a venue in this particular city or province, or it could be spent during this time. So you're giving money features that we don't have today. We can't say, oh, this dollar, you know, in my Cash App account or my Venmo, it can only be used for, you know, Mexican restaurants, right? That doesn't exist. But with programmability, you can now program what the money is spent on or can't be spent on.
Interesting.
It's so interesting. And there are many of these pilots. And so we're looking at this, we're seeing the reporting, and we're thinking, wow, okay, this is interesting. But what's the downside? Right?
Well, you said you won't be able to buy certain books now, I suppose. That'd be one of the downsides.
I mean, you know, we started to think about, you know, because we saw one thing, which was they were rolling these pilots also around government services like elderly payments, social security services, subsidies for your bills. And so they would have like a card, which would usually be your ID card as a social citizen or something, or to get social services or funds. And they would say, oh, well, we're going to put it in ECNY. And so now it's all connected. It's like your identity with this program, but also they're able to track the money potentially. And so we started to see that there's the limits of this programmability are only, only set by what you program. So, for example, what if I want to say that your origin, your national origin? Let me submit you're from a distinct ethnic group, or you're a foreigner. Maybe as a foreigner, I could put certain blockages, or I could tag your payments a certain way. I'm not saying that they've done this, but this is possible.
Yeah, because I know in China you have the social credit situation, and also there is repression against the I pronounce it the Uyghurs. Mm-hmm. Is it Uyghurs or Uyghurs? And so if you don't fit into a certain category, suddenly the government could, in theory, mm-hmm. set up some sort of two-tier system.
Well, let me drive this point home. This is not an kind of relates to the Uyghurs. Now, this is something we found. This was a few years ago. So this is an old news story that most people don't know about in Western countries. So Chris, you ever shop at, probably not you, but maybe your wife, H&M? Have you ever heard of H&M?
Oh, yeah, I know of H&M. Actually, I did buy a jumper from H&M.
Okay, all right, I shouldn't presume.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Okay, so everyone knows H&M Clothers. I forget, they're European, maybe Swedish. I forget, are they Swedish? I don't remember. A few years ago, H&M had posted on one of its blogs a statement about they were concerned about the supply chain of their clothes, and they had a statement about not having clothes that were sourced from the Uyghurs from a certain province in China, and it was something they put up, and it was this was a big topic right several years ago, and several months later, might have been even a year later, and I don't know if the Chinese government sort of they knew about it, and they started a campaign to digitally sanction, I would say, H&M. And here's what they did. Now, this didn't involve the digital yuan, but I'm bringing this up for this as a demonstration of what's possible. So what the government did was it did an anti-H&M campaign that was all digital. And what they did was they removed H&M digitally from services in China. For example, if you wanted to use the Chinese version of Uber to go to H&M in Beijing, it's at the store. You've been there all the time. And you would look, you would say, okay, I'm going to H&M. Not valid. There's no. Now the store is still there. The store is still there, but it was removed. They removed it from the main e-commerce site. They removed all H&M items from the site. And this campaign lasted for several months or maybe over a year. I don't remember exactly until they reversed it. And it was, there was a media campaign. People were saying down with H&M, that sort of thing as well. But what did that show you? It showed you that the state then used the digital instruments within its reach to sanction you, to go after you for not doing it, for getting it, for crossing the line for them. And so what I started to think was, so let's look at this new digital currency. If for some, let's say someone in the NBA tweets about, hey, free Hong Kong or something, and it's possible if the digital yuan were to be, in place, now maybe you could no longer buy NBA tickets in China. Maybe your wallet's NBA in China would not work for a week until you take down that statement, until you apologize, then your wallets will work. Because that's not as possible with current finance. Even the what we think is digital finance, the government can't just easily. Now, there's not one button and all of your accounts will freeze. It doesn't work that way. The ECNY, again, I'm not saying that they are doing this, but what I'm saying is this is a move towards an infrastructure where the state would have more control over wallets, because it'd be digital and it's its own infrastructure. And these are the things, this is why we say a programmable state, where there's the potential for abuse and control and authoritarianism.
Let's take a break and be right back with more.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps.
In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly.
Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Trade with China is an important thing, and will China, you know, change the rules of trade so then people will start have to work in this way? And also, could you get other countries starting to imitate this system as well? Could it be the kind of beginning of a snowball effect?
Yeah. So this is the two great questions, and the first one, the issue of, you know, how could China sort of enforce this? And even though this digital currency, the CBDC, as we call it, central bank digital currency, is not the math, it's not mass adopted, we saw some signs of what I think is the intent to make it the default or the primary system, even though it's not right now. And this was during the Winter Olympics a few years ago. Now, a few years ago, if I remember correctly, the Winter Olympics that were in Beijing, you could only in the Olympic Village, you could only use the ECNY, their CBDC, or Visa. And if I remember correctly, because Visa was a sponsor of the games, you know, so Visa sponsors the game, so they're gonna make sure, oh no, you're gonna have to use Visa. But you couldn't use anything else. No, Alipay, WeChat, and what if your Visa? I don't speak for Visa, but I'm thinking for Visa, you may say, because I think some people were thinking, well, this is competition for Visa, like this is the ECNY, and the government's response would be, this is just our national currency, so it's always going to be available. This is our sovereign currency, so it can't be. You can't Visa have a monopoly and say, oh, I'm the only form of payment. The ECNY is going to be it is China's real default payment system. I think that's what they're going towards. And I think companies, you're talking about trade, those companies that are going to be working in or operating in China, right now the ECNY is, again, it's very limited. It's not available for everyone. But I do think the world is going to be one where if you're in China and you're operating, you're going to have to use it. I think eventually, I think that's the trajectory. Now, maybe not next year, but so you're going to have to grapple with this as an international organization. Well, where is my data? If I use this as opposed to other systems of payments, you know, am I giving more data to the government potentially? Or what are the protections? You know, that's a thing.
Well, and freedom of speech implications too, because I know certainly in the US and UK and other parts of Europe, it's sort of becoming more popular for brands to get involved in certain kind of conversations. Mm. And so should a conversation kind of come up that's maybe sort of not taken well by the Chinese government, is that going to cause an issue?
Absolutely. And to your other question about other countries adopting it. So this was one of the things in our paper that we really thought about towards the end, because, you know, there's something called the, the Belt and Road Initiative.
Yeah, Belt and Road Initiative, yeah.
And so that's, you know, China partnering and working with infrastructure for other countries around the world, trains, bridges, you know, helping with infrastructure as a way to also increase the trade with these countries and extract resources, do development deals, et cetera. And so there's a concern that for all countries now, and maybe this is, we should probably get into this. So what this means for other countries that are thinking about innovating in their technology with finance, innovating in payments, other countries are looking for better ways to manage their own financial system. And they're also thinking of better ways to do cross-border trade, cross-border transactions, so international trade, right? And if you're doing that right now, you know, now there are new alternatives that we didn't have 10, 15 years ago in the world to do trade in a different way. And the ECNY, let's sort of put it aside, but because the ECNY is a fit, but not like most people think. So most people think, when you talk about this, when I would go onto the Hill and talk to staffers in Congress, you know, or members of Congress, you know, their first concern when they would first learn about this is, oh, is this going to compete with the dollar? You know, is this going to be, you know, is this going to diminish the demand for the dollar? Are countries going to want to use this? And I would say they're asking the wrong question. That's not what China's doing. So China has controls on its currencies that limit how much of its local currency can go abroad. So there are already controls. China's not trying to, you know, spread this, its currency, this ECNY, and make everyone else have it. That's not what, and it's not trying to compete with the dollar in the way that the dollar is supreme, where most banks need the dollar, they need it for trade. You know, it's sort of the reserve currency, the international reserve currency. China's not trying to make that with a digital yuan. What China is doing is building other payment alternatives that it hopes will provide a different way to do cross-border trade without going through the regular banking system, which the United States dominates, where the dollar dominates. So it's not to compete to say, oh, I'm going to make the yuan now the most desirable currency over the dollar. No, it's to say, okay, let's use technology and let's set up some new systems for trade that could involve this CBDC, this new digital currency. But I think what they're thinking more about is that if I can get you, country, let's say, I don't know, UAE or Thailand or Saudi Arabia, or, you know, and just name your country, or Ecuador, Mexico, I can get you to have your own central bank digital currency. I have my central bank digital currency. And then when our business people do trade, we create a different platform. You don't go to your bank and then do a wire transfer and go through the SWIFT system. And, you know, the US, you have to do sanctions checks to make sure you're not on the US sanctions list before the transaction goes through. That's how international wires work. That's how cross-border transactions work. How about we do this pilot system? And there is this pilot system that they're doing. It's called Mbridge. And just if you want to know that, you know, there's more on that we could talk about. We'll create a pilot system where we'll simply send your CBDC to this new platform, which is a blockchain-based distributed ledger platform, and then it'll be converted into digital yuan or the ECNY for me in China. And then that is the trade. You've paid it. We've gone through that system. You had a CBDC, you paid it in, and then the buyer receives the CBDC, or the seller receives the CBDC in their local currency. That's a new type of system that would allow us to do international trade without going through the regular banking system. And that's what's being piloted. And the ECNY is somewhat a part of that. It's part of this broader thing. And before, you know, people wonder, am I being, you know, is this a, you know, grand, you know, is this all nefarious? The thing is that pilot, you know, countries that are friendly to the United States are interested in these types of things, because no one, if you're not in the US, no one wants to be so dependent on the dollar. Even in the UK is, you know, I remember several years ago, the previous Bank of England gave a speech where he said, you know, the reliance on the dollar, you know, isn't good for the international economy. We should find alternatives. So all countries, correspondent banking is getting more complicated and pricey. So most countries are looking for different ways. And that's why CBDCs have become a thing. You know, to bring our, I won't go down the rabbit hole on this, but I have to say it because some of your listeners might be thinking of this. The conversation is now changing because now the world is looking at a different type of crypto asset, stable coins, as a way to do trade. Stable coins are simply cryptocurrencies that are backed by a regular asset, like a fiat currency. So a US dollar stablecoin is a crypto asset. It's on a distributed ledger. You can send it 24/7. You can program it. You could do all these things, but it's still a cryptocurrency, but its value is always $1 because it's pegged to that amount. And there's dollars, you know, in the background where it's been put in reserve. And now you can use this like a crypto asset, send it anytime, you know, do a bunch of different things with it. It's auditable. You can kind of see the transactions, which you can't with regular money. You can't go to a blockchain and look at regular money.
Yeah. So does that make then that transaction, quote unquote, more reliable because it's related to something kind of physical?
I would say it makes it less volatile because the price, the value of it is set. Whereas with Bitcoin, you know, if I send you, you know, 0.0, let's say I send you one Bitcoin, which I wouldn't do because that's like $130,000 worth of one Bitcoin is worth $130,000. But let's just say for fun's sake, I send you one Bitcoin, but then the value may drop. And so you don't get it. A stable coin is it's the same infrastructure. It's the same technology, roughly, or it's similar technology. But when you go to redeem it, you know that the dollar is going to be worth the $1. So it does. So if you say it's more stable in that sense.
Yeah, got you.
So stable coins have become very popular outside of the US. US dollar stable coins, because in places where they have less access to banking, or the banking fees, you know, are high or take too much, some traders, import exporters, have been using US dollar stable coins to settle the trade because, hey, I can just get this cryptocurrency, it's based on the dollar, and I'll purchase my supplies from this country and I'll just pay them that. It stays a dollar, so the value is the same. Why should I go through the bank and do a bank wire when I can just do this crypto asset transaction? So that's why stable coins have become very popular around the world as a new phenomenon.
Yeah. How does the rise of sort of cryptocurrencies then challenge sort of government's traditional control over money? And what does that mean for sort of national security and democracies?
It's multifaceted, like most things, right? Because Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies have been around for a while. And I think governments are going through, there's sort of like not only a learning curve, but there's this sort of arc in terms of, it's like an arc, like a character in a movie. It's like, this is the beginning, and then you figure out what the problem is, and then you know, there's some sort of maybe resolution. And I think that's what's happened with cryptocurrency. When Bitcoin first came, it was, wait a second, this, we didn't develop this, you know, as a government, you know, all these illicit actors are going to use it. And that's what we did see. I mean, I first started getting into this because I saw a terrorist funding campaign that was using Bitcoin back in the day. We might've even we probably talked about it years ago. And so that was how governments were responding. And they were concerned that, okay, this is taking away from the money supply, from our dollar. Depends on the country, because in Nigeria, this became a huge issue because the Naira, the Nigerian country, started, you know, really going down, huge inflation, and people were using cryptocurrency to try to maintain the value. And so they really cracked down on the crypto sector. So the early stage of government response in many countries has been fear and doubt.
Well, yeah, there is a lot of fear about it, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. But that has changed. And the U.S. is really a good example, because the U.S. Did establish some regulations for the illicit finance, anti-money laundering for crypto exchanges way back in 2013. I actually give the U.S. like kudos for doing a good job there. But generally, you saw here in the U.S., especially it was sort of came to its height in the previous administration, the Biden administration, there was so much aversion to this cryptocurrency stuff, especially after the FTX fraud debacle. You know, most people, many policymakers didn't want to hear anything about crypto. What is this crypto stuff? And, but at the same time, there were, and also there's the casino nature of so much of the crypto, because the price, I mean, a lot of, it's basically glorified gambling, you know, is what so much of the crypto phenom has been. And so a lot of distasteful stuff, if I'm honest. But at the same time, you always had people, developers, projects that were saying, okay, yeah, that casino culture stuff, you know, that's, I guess it's part of, we have to deal with it. But really what's interesting here is that we can make payments better. We can make digital finance better. And we can even make our economy better, because now we can start doing interesting things. We can start programming money. We can have micropayments. Like, you can't do a 0.002 cent payment in our traditional funding. But with cryptocurrencies, it's just software. You can program it and do tiny, tiny micropayments. Maybe we could do that for renewable energy systems, where you share energy and then you get paid even minute amounts of funding. That's possible with blockchain-based cryptocurrencies. So now where we are is that I think regulators, I deal a lot with regulators in my work. Regulators have, they've gone past the knee-jerk reaction of, okay, this stuff doesn't make sense. And they're now realizing, cryptocurrencies are here to stay, so we have to regulate them. Because if you don't regulate this environment, it's going to be all this fraudsters and hacks and all this stuff. And so that's where we're getting. I would actually say crypto is entering its adult phase right now with regulation.
Cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology more broadly, they give sort of authoritarian states like Russia and Iran ways to bypass Western sanctions. And what you described earlier with China's system, again, is that going to be a way around sanctions, which makes sanctions almost null and void?
So, you know, there's what I would say is all of this stuff, it's not that these efforts like the ECNY or the Enbridge, or even, you know, Russia had been experimenting with its own digital currency, Iran, as you mentioned, right? These countries, they've been trying. I don't think that all of these efforts themselves are going to be very successful. There's a lot of limitations, a lot of challenges. You know, the financial system is so complicated. It takes a lot, and you have to be able to create a system where many countries want to use it. It can't just be the rogue nations. The rogue nations, you know, then, you know, what can you do? It's just a bunch of the rogues, you know? You have to have a system that's an alternative that many countries will start to use or want to use. The way I describe it is, it doesn't have to be a replacement to the regular banking system or the SWIFT system, which is where you have international wire transfers. It just has to be what I call a viable alternative. So something that is viable, so it works, you know that you can use it, and it's an alternative, you know, for enough countries. So maybe it's not for, maybe a lot of the rich countries don't use this new system that gets developed. But if enough middle-income countries and low-income countries that maybe have a lot of resources, that have a desire to trade, if those countries support a new system, if, you know, China has its own payment system that's separate, if it sort of gets more attractive. So this is I think it is a real threat. It's a real risk that other countries, that the US in particular, has to address, but it's not going to happen overnight. And my sense is right now where we are in the US, the US finally sort of sees this issue and is being more proactive. I mean, the Trump administration has a very different focus and very different focus when it comes to digital assets and cryptocurrencies. Very pro, and is seeing this technology as a way to compete or to bring something of value as opposed to just something to fear.
Do you feel broadly policymakers are on top of this? Because I find across the spectrum, you know, both conservative, Labour, Democrat, Republican in the state, that a lot of politicians tend to be a bit behind the curve on these things. Do you feel the right people are really on it as they should be?
I know in the US, but generally speaking, regulators, government people, even the financial regulators tend to all generally be way behind because most of these developments are software developments, and the software is always happening much faster than even regular policymaking and even financial policymaking. Right? Banking and software are two different worlds. Like software tech is, they iterate quickly, they do different things, they program, they're creating all these new things. Banking, because it's so regulated, moves slowly, doesn't adapt to change. And so the policymakers are usually more in line with the banking side. And for several years, it's always been the case that regulators have been behind. That's not to say, because again, I know, you know, many of these regulators talk to them. There's always a minority of people who are very much into it, because the thing about this stuff is you can go down the rabbit hole so quickly, because this stuff, I think it's fascinating. I mean, once you get into it, even if you're not a developer, I'm not a programmer, I'm not a tech guy per se, but once you start, you get the main concepts and you see what's possible, it's really interesting. So if you're a curious person, you learn a lot about it. And I think most governments, they kind of have one, you know, in each department, there's like one or two people who are into the digital asset thing and everyone else doesn't know what they're talking about. That's kind of the case right now.
Let's take a break and be right back with more.
Hey, Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Looking ahead then, where, you know, looking maybe 10 years ahead, where do you think the kind of global financial system's going with all of this?
We're going to, so there's, I don't know at the end. I mean, obviously, right? I mean, there's, I'm not going to be so brass to say I know exactly. But I would say that there's a transition period that we're in right now. And we're in this period of competing formats for money, competing digital formats, you know, because what it means is there's like the regular banking that people have always done. There's the mobile money, you know, which is like the money app, the mobile money applications that people are using, which people are already very used to, and they use them a lot, the fintechs, as we call them. There's cryptocurrencies, which don't have that as much uptick in terms of daily use, but you know, they're out there. But the stablecoins is actually, I think, going to be, that's what I would say to watch out for, because everyone's familiar with cryptocurrencies, but people don't use cryptocurrencies. You know, they trade them. They trade them. Stablecoins are going to be different because they've already been used overseas a lot where people found value. But what's happening now in the United States is the U.S. Congress passed a bill called the Genius Act, and the president signed it into law. So it is now law that stablecoins in the U.S. are regulated. And banks are going to be allowed and approved to use and issue stablecoins. So what that means, and now just looking 2 years ahead, a year and a half ahead, this means that banks are going to be figuring out if a stablecoin can make their lives easier and can be better at conducting transactions than the infrastructure they use. And it's not just only for the consumer. The law actually states that banks could use stablecoins between themselves, because banks have transactions, you know, interbank in between each other, where it's a really clunky process, and there are fees associated with how they, you know, exchange money between banks. Stablecoins may make those transactions easier, especially overseas. So basically, a lot of stuff is going to change. Our banking system is going to change, and there may be new formats for us to use. And on the international side, these efforts to create like an alternative trading platform that the U.S. is not involved in, those things are going to continue. They may or may not be successful, but things are up in the air now, and we need to pay attention to it.
Yeah, definitely. What should listeners and policymakers be looking at or reading to kind of get a better understanding of all of this? Because it is quite an intimidating subject. And as you're saying, it can go down a rabbit hole. And personally, I probably wouldn't recommend just going on YouTube and randomly watching stuff about Bitcoin, because that could take you to all sorts of places.
Yeah.
So where should people be going to kind of get decent information on this?
I'll name drop one. There's one Substack that I subscribe to called Crypto is Macro Now. It may be a little bit beyond, because it's written by Noelle Atchison. She's a really good observer. She's like an economist, but she's really into crypto, and she's looking at all of these developments that are happening. She's based in Europe, and I think people might like her stuff. Crypto is Macro on Substack. So I'd recommend that. And, you know, there are lots of other crypto publications, news publications. There's the CoinDesk and Blockworks. There are a few other, you know, there are few, you know, crypto publications where you can go to find out kind of what's going on. Books. I will recommend a book that I just read recently. I'll recommend this book called Read, Write, Own. And it's by Chris Dixon. Chris Dixon is at Andreessen Horowitz. I believe he's the head of Andreessen Horowitz, the big VC firm in Silicon Valley. They're crypto. They have a crypto investment. They invest in a whole bunch of investments in crypto projects in particular. And that book is good. It does get a little technical, but I think it's written for people who aren't technical. And it sort of explains how all this blockchain technology stuff fits into the development of the internet overall. And his thesis, without, you know, not a spoil, but I mean, his main thesis is that the blockchain technology that we're seeing, you know, it's not just for the financial aspect. It's a new way for managing data on the internet. And his thesis is that potentially in a way where users will have more control, and where you don't have to be beholden to like big corporations and the attention economy. So that's one thing. I think some people would be fascinated by that, because it gives a way of looking at this. And, you know, and there are critics out there. So, I mean, but I think I would start with some resources like that.
Brilliant, brilliant. And is there anything else sort of important to you about anything that we've discussed today that we haven't touched upon?
I mean, so we kind of touched on it, but I would say the issue of U.S. economic sanctions is the big, I want to put a finer point on it, which is the power of U.S. sanctions right now is based on the importance of the dollar and the importance of the U.S. banking system, right? Mm. So, because if you get sanctioned, you're out of luck. If, you know, you can't transact digitally, you can't transact with banks. And so these developments are important, because as that shifts, if there are shifts in this sort of the financial system where it's some alternative, because the way that we've had it since World War II, since the end of World War II, we're dominated by the U.S. I mean, it was the U.S. and the U.K. Hey, it was you and me, Chris. Our nations crafted this world order. It's this Bretton Woods world order.
Yeah, and that special relationship.
Yeah, that special relationship. And it was all the institutions, the IMF, the U.S. All of this, you know, was with U.S. power. And that financial economic statecraft that the U.S. has been able to do, all of that now, it is up for grabs. We're no longer in the Cold War. That everything is shifting. So this type of stuff, even though, you know, some people may hype one change, I'm not saying the ECNY is going to be the death of U.S. sanctions or anything like that. I'm just saying we're in a moment where there's so many shifts to watch, and it's going to be interesting. There's going to be a competition for how does the future digital economy look like and who has control of it. And I'll end maybe with this one thought. This is sometimes when I do presentations, I'll end with this. And I have a slide, but I can't have the slide. So hopefully listeners will see this in their mind. You know that there was a time where the world geopolitical power was based on how much gold you had, right? That was for centuries. That was what was most important to countries, to your geopolitical power. Post-World War II, eventually, we, you know, especially after we left the gold standard, it was how much access of the dollar do you have? Having the dollar was very important for your geopolitical standing and power, et cetera. So that's what people are thinking. They're thinking, okay, yes, the dollar, what, you know, is another currency going to eclipse it? My assessment of the environment is different. It's not that there's going to be another currency. What I would say is that the next sort of reserve asset that is important is about data. it's about data. And it's not just how much data you have, but how you use data. And that's why these conversations about AI, you know, are so important, because what you're seeing is that the nation that has the best data is able to do much with its data, leads to some economic and some military benefits, some you know, administrative benefits. Data, I think, is becoming the next resource. And again, it's not just how much data you have, but what you do with the data. That's all this digital stuff is. It's that now you have, everything is based on data. So I would end by saying, don't worry so much about, is the yuan going to be more valuable than the dollar or the euro? I mean, yeah, that stuff is important for the economists out there. But I really think geopolitically what's happening is the state and our and your business's relationship and use of data is going to be the important asset that will dictate who has leverage in the global order.
Cool. Thank you very much for that. So Yo-Yo, where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
Yeah, I am notoriously bad with social media. I do not.
In some ways, that's not a bad thing.
Oh, man, yes.
Might give you a lot of peace.
Oh, yes. Much more peace, much more happier now. I mean, if people find me, I mean, you know, yeah, I am on X at Sine Curve. I spell it differently, S-I-G-N Curve. But I don't really post there. LinkedIn is kind of, because I deal a lot with anti-money laundering regulation. So LinkedIn, if you just look for Yaya Jatta Fanusi, I'm there. And just look for me in podcasting. I should mention, you know, I'll put a plug. I'm involved in two podcast projects, the Jabari Lincoln Files, which we talked about on your show.
Yep.
That was
Fantastic.
A few years
yep.
ago. Thanks so much. And I know some listeners who came to the podcast. So that's my spy thriller. Yeah, my spy thriller podcast. And I'm also working with Illicit Edge. I have a podcast which will be having new episodes soon called Designated, which deals with financial crime, illicit finance issues. That's more of a show like this, an interview show. So you can find me in the podcasting world.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining me on the show. It's great to have you back on, and I hope to have you again in the future.
Wonderful. Thanks, Chris. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
For listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
About Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right Rug.